Thank you. Thank you all very, very much. Thank you. Please. Thank you so much. Madam Speaker, Madam Vice President, and our First Lady and Second Gentleman, members of Congress and the Cabinet, Justice of the Supreme Court, my fellow Americans. Last year, COVID-19 kept us apart. This year, we're finally together again. Tonight, we meet as Democrats, Republicans, and Independents, but most importantly, as Americans, with the duty to one another, to America, to the American people, to the Constitution, and an unwavering resolve that freedom will always triumph over tyranny. 6 days ago, Russia's Vladimir Putin sought to shake the very foundations of the free world, thinking he could make it bend to his menacing ways. But he badly miscalculated. He thought he could roll into Ukraine and the world would roll over. Instead, he met with a wall of strength he never anticipated or imagined. He met the Ukrainian people. President Zelensky, to every Ukrainian, their fearlessness, their courage, their determination literally inspires the world. Groups of citizens blocking tanks with their bodies. Everyone from students to retirees to teachers turned soldiers defending their homeland. And in this struggle, President Zelensky said in his speech to the European Parliament, "Light will win over darkness." The Ukrainian ambassador to the United States is here tonight, sitting with the First Lady. Let each of us, if you're able to stand, stand and send an unmistakable signal to the world, to Ukraine. Thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you. She's bright, she's strong, and she's resolved. Yes. We, the United States of America, stand with the Ukrainian people. Throughout our history, we've learned this lesson. When dictators do not pay a price for their aggression, they cause more chaos. They keep moving. And the cost, the threats to America and America to the world keeps rising. That's why the NATO alliance was created, to secure peace and stability in Europe after World War II. The United States is a member, along with 29 other nations. It matters. American diplomacy matters. American resolve matters. Putin's latest attack on Ukraine was premeditated and totally unprovoked. He rejected repeated efforts at diplomacy. He thought the West and NATO wouldn't respond. He thought he could divide us at home, in this chamber, in this nation. He thought he could divide us in Europe as well. But Putin was wrong. We are ready. We are united, and that's what we did. We stayed united. We prepared extensively and carefully. We spent months building coalitions of other freedom-loving nations in Europe and the Americas, from America to the Asian and African continents, to confront Putin. Like many of you, I spent countless hours unifying our European allies. We shared with the world in advance what we knew Putin was planning and precisely how we would try to falsify and justify his aggression. We countered Russia's lies with the truth. And now, now that he's acted, the free world is holding him accountable, along with 27 members of the European Union, including France, Germany, Italy, as well as countries like the United Kingdom, Canada, Japan, Korea, Australia, New Zealand, and many others, even Switzerland, are inflicting pain on Russia and supporting the people of Ukraine. Putin is now isolated from the world more than he has ever been. Together, together, along with our allies, we are right now enforcing powerful economic sanctions. We're cutting off Russia's largest banks in the international financial system, preventing Russia's central bank from defending the Russian ruble, making Putin's $630 billion war fund worthless. We're choking Russia's access to technology that will sap its economic strength and weaken its military for years to come. Tonight, I say to the Russian oligarchs and the corrupt leaders who bilk billions of dollars off this violent regime, no more. The United States, I mean it. The United States Department of Justice is assembling a dedicated task force to go after the crimes of the Russian oligarchs. We're joining with European allies to find and seize their yachts, their luxury apartments, their private jets. We're coming for you, ill-begotten gains. And tonight, I'm announcing that we will join our allies in closing off American airspace to all Russian flights, further isolating Russia and adding additional squeeze on their economy. He has no idea what's coming. The ruble has already lost 30% of its value. The Russian stock market has lost 40% of its value, and trading remains suspended. The Russian economy is reeling, and Putin alone is the one to blame. Together with our allies, we're providing support to the Ukrainians in their fight for freedom. Military assistance, economic assistance, humanitarian assistance. We're giving more than $1 billion of direct assistance to Ukraine and will continue to aid the Ukrainian people as they defend their country and help ease their suffering. But let me be clear. Our forces are not engaged and will not engage in the conflict with Russian forces in Ukraine. Our forces are not going to Europe to fight Ukraine, but to defend our NATO allies in the event that Putin decides to keep moving west. For that purpose, we have mobilized American ground forces, air squadrons, ship deployments to protect NATO countries, including Poland, Romania, Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia. And as I've made crystal clear, the United States and our allies will defend every inch of territory that is NATO territory with the full force of our collective power. Every single inch. And we're clear-eyed. The Ukrainians are fighting back with pure courage. But the next few days, weeks, and months will be hard on them. Putin has unleashed violence and chaos, but while he may make gains on the battlefield, he'll pay a continuing high price over the long run. And a pound of Ukrainian people, the proud, proud people, pound for pound, ready to fight with every inch of energy they have. They've known 30 years of independence, have repeatedly shown that they will not tolerate anyone who tries to take their country backwards. To all Americans, I'll be honest with you, as I always promised I would be. A Russian dictator invading a foreign country has cost around the world. And I'm taking robust action to make sure the pain of our sanctions is targeted at Russian economy and that we use every tool at our disposal to protect American businesses and consumers. Tonight, I can announce the United States has worked with 30 other countries to release 60 million barrels of oil from reserves around the world. America will lead that effort, releasing 30 million barrels of our own strategic petroleum reserve. And we stand ready to do more if necessary, united with our allies. These steps will help blunt gas prices here at home, but I know news about what's happening can seem alarming to all Americans. But I want you to know, we're going to be okay. We're going to be okay. When the history of this era is written, Putin's war in Ukraine will have left Russia weaker and the rest of the world stronger. While it shouldn't have taken something so terrible for people around the world to see what's at stake, now everyone sees it clearly. We see the unity among leaders of nations, a more unified Europe, a more unified West. We see unity among the people who are gathering in cities and large crowds around the world, even in Russia, to demonstrate their support for the people of Ukraine. In the battle between democracy and autocracies, democracies are rising to the moment, and the world is clearly choosing the side of peace and security. This is the real test, and it's going to take time. So let us continue to draw inspiration from the iron will of the Ukrainian people. To our fellow Ukrainian Americans, who forged a deep bond that connects our two nations, we stand with you. We stand with you. Putin may circle Kyiv with tanks, but he'll never gain the hearts and souls of the Iranian people. He'll never extinguish their love of freedom, and he will never, never weaken the resolve of the free world. We meet tonight in an America that has lived through two of the hardest years this nation has ever faced. The pandemic has been punishing, and so many families are living paycheck to paycheck, struggling to keep up with the rising cost of food, gas, housing, and so much more. I understand, like many of you did. My dad had to leave his home in Scranton, Pennsylvania, to find work. So like many of you, I grew up in a family when the price of food went up, it was felt throughout the family. It had an impact. That's when one of the first things I did as president was fight to pass the American Rescue Plan. Because people were hurting, we needed to act, and we did. Few pieces of legislation have done more at a critical moment in our history to lift us out of a crisis. It fueled our efforts to vaccinate the nation and combat COVID-19, delivered immediate economic relief to tens of millions of Americans. It helped put food on the table. Remember those long lines of cars waiting for hours just to get a box of food put in their trunk? It cut the cost of health care insurance. And as my dad used to say, it gave the people just a little bit of breathing room. Unlike the $2 trillion tax cut passed in the previous administration that benefited the top 1% of Americans, the American Rescue Plan helped working people and left no one behind. Folks, and it worked. It worked. It worked. We created jobs, lots of jobs. In fact, our economy created over 6.5 million new jobs just last year. More jobs in one year than ever before in the history of the United States of America. The economy grew at a rate of 5.7 last year, the strongest growth rate in 40 years, and the first step in bringing fundamental change to our economy that hasn't worked for working people in this nation for too long. For the past 40 years, we were told that tax break for those at the top and benefits would trickle down and everyone would benefit. But that trickle-down theory led to a weaker economic growth, lower wages, bigger deficits, and a widening gap between the top and everyone else in nearly a century. Look, Vice President Harris and I ran for office, and I realize we have fundamental disagreements on this, but ran for office with a new economic vision for America. Invest in America, educate Americans, grow the workforce, build the economy from the bottom up and the middle out, not from the top down, because we know Because we know when the middle class grows, the poor have a way up and the wealthy do very well. America used to have the best roads, bridges, and airports on earth. And now our infrastructure is ranked 13th in the world. We won't be able to compete for the jobs of the 21st century if we don't fix it. That's why it was so important to pass the bipartisan infrastructure law. And I thank my Republican friends for joining. To invest and rebuild America, the single biggest investment in history. It was a bipartisan effort, and I want to thank the members of both parties who worked to make it happen. We're done talking about infrastructure weeks. We're now talking about an infrastructure decade. And look, it's going to transform America, to put us in a path to win the economic competition of the 21st century that we face with the rest of the world, particularly China. I told Xi Jinping, it's never been a good bet to bet against the American people. We'll create good jobs for millions of Americans, modernizing roads, airports, ports, waterways, all across America. And we'll do it to withstand the devastating effects of climate change and promote environmental justice. We'll build a national network of 500,000 electric vehicle charging stations. Begin to replace the poisonous lead pipes so every child, every American, has clean water to drink at home and at school. We're going to provide affordable, high-speed internet for every American, rural, suburban, urban, and tribal communities. 4,000 projects have already been announced. Many of you have announced them in your districts. And tonight, I'm announcing that this year, we will start fixing over 65,000 miles of highway and 1,500 bridges in disrepair. And folks, when we use taxpayers' dollars to rebuild America, we're going to do it by buying America. Buy American products. Support American jobs. The federal government spends about $600 billion a year to keep this country safe and secure. There's been a law on the books for almost a century to make sure taxpayers' dollars support American jobs and businesses. Every administration, Democrat and Republican, says they'll do it, but we're actually doing it. We'll buy America to make sure everything from the deck of an aircraft carrier to the steel on highway guardrails is made in America from beginning to end. All of it. All of it. But folks, to compete for the jobs of the future, we also need a level playing field with China and other competitors. That's why it's so important to pass the Bipartisan Innovation Act sitting in Congress that will make record investments in emerging technologies and American manufacturing. We used to invest almost 2% of our GDP in research and development. We don't now. China is. Let me give you one example why it's so important to pass. If you travel 20 miles east of Columbus, Ohio, you'll find 1,000 empty acres of land. It won't look like much, but if you stop and look closely, you'll see a field of dreams, the ground on which America's future will be built. That's where Intel, the American company that helped build Silicon Valley, is going to build a $20 billion semiconductor megasite. up to 8 state-of-the-art factories in one place, 10,000 new jobs. And in those factories, the average job about $135,000 a year. Some of the most sophisticated manufacturing in the world to make computer chips the size of a fingertip, the power of the world in everyday lives, from smartphones, technology, the internet, technology is yet to be invented. But that's just the beginning. Intel CEO Pat Gelsinger, who is here tonight, I don't know where Pat is. Pat, there you go. Pat, stand up. Pat came to see me, and he told me they're ready to increase their investment from $20 billion to $100 billion. That would be the biggest investment in manufacturing in American history. And all they're waiting for is for you to pass this bill. So let's not wait any longer. Send it to my desk. I'll sign it. And we'll really take off in a big way. And folks, Intel is not alone. There's something happening in America. Just look around and you'll see an amazing story. The rebirth of pride that comes from stamping products made in America. The revitalization of American manufacturing. Companies are choosing to build new factories here when just a few years ago they would have gone overseas. That's what's happening. Ford is investing $11 billion in electric vehicles, creating 11,000 jobs across the country. GM is making the largest investment in its history, $7 billion to build electric vehicles, creating 4,000 jobs in Michigan. All told, 369,000 new manufacturing jobs were created in America last year alone. Folks, by people I've met like JoJo Burgess from generations of union steelworkers in Pittsburgh, who's here tonight. Where are you, JoJo? There you go. Thanks, buddy. As Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown says, it's time to bury the label Rust Belt. It's time to see the what used to be called the Rust Belt become the home of a significant resurgence of manufacturing. And with all the bright spots in our economy, record job growth, higher wages, too many families are struggling to keep up with their bills. Inflation is robbing them of gains they thought otherwise they would be able to feel. I get it. That's why my top priority is getting prices under control. Look, our economy roared back faster than almost anyone predicted. But the pandemic meant that businesses had a hard time hiring enough people because of the pandemic to keep up production in their factories. So you didn't have people making those beams that went into buildings because they were out. The factory was closed. The panic also disrupted the global supply chain. Factories closed. When that happens, it takes longer to make goods and get them to the warehouses, to the stores, and prices go up. Look at cars last year. 1/3 of all the inflation was because of automobile sales. There weren't enough semiconductors to make all the cars that people wanted to buy. And guess what? Prices of automobiles went way up, especially used vehicles as well. And so we have a choice. One way to fight inflation is to drive down wages and make Americans poorer. I think I have a better idea to fight inflation. Lower your costs, not your wages. And folks, that means make more cars and semiconductors in America, more infrastructure and innovation in America, more goods moving faster and cheaper in America. More jobs where you can earn a good living in America. Instead of relying on foreign supply chains, let's make it in America. Look, economists. Increasing the productive capacity of our economy. I call it building a better America. My plan to fight inflation will lower your cost and lower the deficit. 17 Nobel laureates in economics said my plan will ease long-term inflationary pressures. Top business leaders, and I believe most Americans support the plan. And here's the plan. First, cut the cost of prescription drugs. We pay more for the same drug produced by the same company in America than any other country in the world. Just look at insulin. 1 in 10 Americans has diabetes. In Virginia, I met a 13-year-old boy, the handsome young man standing up there, Joshua Davis. Dad both have type 1 diabetes, which means they need insulin every single day. Insulin costs about $10 a vial to make. That's what it costs the pharmaceutical company. But drug companies charge families like Joshua and his dad up to 30 times that amount. I spoke with Joshua's mom. Imagine what it's like to look at your child who needs insulin to stay healthy and have no idea how in God's name you're going to be able to pay for it. What it does to your family, but what it does to your dignity, your ability to look your child in the eye, to be the parent you expect yourself to be. I really mean to think about that. That's what I think about. You know, yesterday, Joshua's here tonight, but yesterday was his birthday. Happy birthday, buddy, by the way. For Joshua and 200,000 other young people with type 1 diabetes, let's cap the cost of insulin at $35 a month. So everyone can afford it. And drug companies will do very, very well, their profit margin. While we're at it, I know we have great disagreements on this floor with this. Let's let Medicare negotiate the price of prescription drugs. Set the price for VA drugs. Look, the American Rescue Plan is helping millions of families with Affordable Care Act plans to save them $2,400 a year on their health premiums. Let's close the coverage gap and make these savings permanent. And second, let's cut energy costs for families. An average of $500 a year by combating climate change. Let's provide an investment tax credit to weatherize your home and your business, to be energy efficient and get a tax credit for it. Double America's clean energy production in solar, wind, and so much more. Lower the price of electric vehicles, saving another $80 a month that you're not going to have to pay at the pump. Folks, the third thing we can do to change the standard of living for hardworking folks is cut the cost of child care. Cut the cost of child care. Folks, if you live in a major city in America, you pay up to $14,000 a year for child care per child. I was a single dad for 5 years, raising 2 kids. I had a lot of help, though. I had a mom, a dad, a brother, and a sister that really helped. But middle-class and working folks shouldn't have to pay more than 7% of their income to care for the young children. My plan would cut the cost of child care in half for most families and help parents, including millions of women who left the workforce during the pandemic because they couldn't afford child care, to be able to get back to work, generating economic growth. But my plan doesn't stop there. It also includes home and long-term care. more affordable housing, pre-K for 3- and 4-year-olds. All these will lower costs for families. And under my plan, nobody, let me say this again, nobody earning less than $400,000 a year will pay an additional penny in new taxes. Not a single penny. I may be wrong, but my guess is if we took a secret ballot in this floor, that we'd all agree that the present tax system ain't fair. We have to fix it. I'm not looking to punish anybody. But let's make corporations and wealthy Americans start paying their fair share. Look, last year, and like Chris Coons and Tom Carper and my distinguished congresswoman, we come from the land of corporate America. There are more corporations incorporated in America than every other state in America combined. And I still won 36 years in a row. The point is, even they understand they should pay just a fair share. Last year, 55 of the Fortune 500 companies earned $40 billion in profit and paid zero in federal taxes. Now look, it's not fair. That's why I proposed the 15% minimum tax rate for corporations. And that's why in the G7 and other meetings overseas, we're able to put together, I was able to be somewhat helpful, 130 countries to agree on a global minimum tax rate. So companies can't get out of paying their taxes at home by shipping jobs and factories overseas. It'll raise billions of dollars. That's why I propose closing loopholes for the very wealthy who don't pay, who pay a lower tax rate than a teacher and a firefighter. So that's my plan, but we have to go in more detail later. We will grow the economy, lower the cost of families. So what are we waiting for? Let's get this done. We all know we've got to make changes. Folks, and while you're at it, confirm my nominees for the Federal Reserve, which plays a critical role in fighting inflation. My plan will not only lower costs and give families a fair shot, it will lower the deficit. The previous administration not only ballooned the deficit with those tax cuts for the very wealthy and corporations, it undermined the watchdogs, the job of those to keep pandemic relief funds being wasted. Remember we had those debates about whether or not those watchdogs should be able to see every day how much money was being spent, where was it going to the right place? But in my administration, the watchdogs are back. And we're going to go after the criminals who stole billions of relief money meant for small business and millions of Americans. And tonight, I'm announcing that the Justice Department will soon name a chief prosecutor for pandemic fraud. And look, I think we all agree, thank you. By the end of this year, the deficit will be down to less than half of what it was before I took office. The only president ever to cut the deficit by more than $1 trillion in a single year. Lowering your cost also meant demanding more competition. I'm a capitalist, but capitalism without competition is not capitalism. Capitalism without competition is exploitation. It drives up profits. And corporations have to compete. Their profits go up and your prices go up when they don't have to compete. Small businesses and family farmers and ranchers, I need not tell some of my Republican friends from those states. Guess what? You got 4 basic meatpacking facilities. That's it. You play with them or you don't get to play at all. And you pay a hell of a lot more. A hell of a lot more because there's only 4. See what's happening with ocean carriers moving goods in and out of America. During the pandemic, about half a dozen or less foreign-owned companies raised prices by as much as 1,000% and made record profits. Tonight, I'm announcing a crackdown on those companies overcharging American businesses and consumers. Folks, and as Wall Street firms take over more nursing homes, quality in those homes has gone down and costs have gone up. That ends on my watch. Medicare is going to set higher standards for nursing homes and make sure your loved ones get the care they deserve and that they inspect and they will look at closely. We're also going to cut costs to keep the economy going strong and giving workers a fair shot, provide more training and apprenticeships, hire them based on skills, not just their degrees. Let's pass the Paycheck Fairness Act and paid leave. Raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour. And extend the child tax credit so no one has to raise a family in poverty. Let's increase Pell Grants, increase our historic support for HBCUs, and invest in what Jill, our First Lady, who teaches full-time, calls America's best-kept secret, community colleges. Look, let's pass the PRO Act. When a majority of workers want to form a union, they shouldn't be able to be stopped. When we invest in our workers and we build an economy from the bottom up and the middle out together, we can do something we haven't done in a long time, build a better America. For more than 2 years, COVID has impacted every decision in our lives and the life of this nation. And I know you're tired, frustrated, and exhausted. That doesn't even count the close to a million people who sit at a dining room table or a kitchen table and look at an empty chair because they lost somebody. But I also know this, because of the progress we've made, because of your resilience and the tools that we have been provided by this Congress, tonight I can say we're moving forward safely back to more normal routines. We've reached a new moment in the fight against COVID-19, where severe cases are down to a level not seen since July of last year. Just a few days ago, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention issued a new mask guidelines. Under the new guidelines, most Americans and most of the country can now go mask-free. And based on projections, more of the country will reach across the next couple of weeks. And thanks to the progress we've made in the past year, COVID-19 no longer need control our lives. I know some are talking about living with COVID-19, but tonight I say that we never will just accept living with COVID-19. We'll continue to combat the virus as we do other diseases. And because this virus mutates and spreads, we have to stay on guard. And here are four common sense steps as we move forward safely, in my view. First, stay protected with vaccines and treatments. We know how incredibly effective vaccines are. If you're vaccinated and boosted, you have the highest degree of protection. We'll never give up on vaccinating more Americans. Now, I know parents with kids under 5 are eager to see their vaccines authorized for their children. Scientists are working hard to get that done. We'll be ready with plenty of vaccines if and when they do. We're all ready. We are also ready with antiviral treatments. If you get COVID-19, the Pfizer pill reduces your chances of ending up in the hospital by 90%. I've ordered more pills than anyone in the world has. Pfizer is working overtime to get us a million pills this month and more than double that next month. And now we're launching the Test to Treat initiative. So people can get tested at a pharmacy and if they prove positive, receive the antiviral pills on the spot at no cost. Folks, if you're immunocompromised or have some other vulnerability, we have treatments and free high-quality masks. We're leaving no one behind or ignoring anyone's needs as we move forward. On testing, we've made hundreds of millions of tests available, and you can order them for free to your doorstep. And we've already ordered free tests. If you already ordered free tests tonight, I'm announcing you can order another group of tests, go to covidtest.gov starting next week and you can get more tests. Second, we must prepare for new variants. Over the past, we've gotten much better at detecting new variants. If necessary, we'll be able to develop new vaccines within 100 days instead of maybe months or years. And if Congress provides the funds we need, we'll have new stockpiles of tests, masks, pills ready if needed. I can't promise a new variant won't come, but I can promise you we'll do everything within our power to be ready if it does. Third, we can end the shutdown of schools and businesses. We have the tools we need. It's time for America to get back to work and fill our great downtowns again with people. People working from home can feel safe and begin to return to their offices. We're doing that here in the federal government. The vast majority of federal workers will once again work in person. Our schools are open. Let's keep it that way. Our kids need to be in school. With 75% of adult Americans fully vaccinated and hospitalizations down by 77%, most Americans can remove their masks and stay in the classroom and move forward safely. We achieved this because we provided free vaccines, treatments, tests, and masks. Of course, continuing this costs money, so I'll not surprise you. I'll be back to see y'all. And I'm going to soon send a request to Congress. The vast majority of Americans have used these tools and may want again. We may need them again, so I expect Congress, and I hope you'll pass that quickly. Fourth, we'll continue vaccinating the world. We've sent 475 million vaccine doses to 112 countries, more than any nation on Earth. We won't stop, because you can't build a wall high enough to keep out a vaccine. The vaccine can stop the spread of these diseases. You know, we've lost so much in COVID-19. Time with one another. The worst of all, the loss of life. Let's use this moment to reset. So stop looking at COVID as a partisan dividing line. See it for what it is, a god-awful disease. Let's stop seeing each other as enemies and start seeing each other for who we are, fellow Americans. Look. We can't change how divided we've been. It was a long time in coming. But we can change how to move forward on COVID-19 and other issues that we must face together. I recently visited New York City Police Department days after the funerals of Officer Wilbur Mora and his partner, Officer Jason Rivera. They're responding to a 9/11 call when a man shot and killed them with a stolen gun. Officer Mora was 27 years old. Officer Rivera was 22 years old. Both Dominican Americans who grew up in the same streets that they later chose to patrol as police officers. I spoke with their families, and I told them that we are forever in debt for their sacrifices and will carry on their mission to restore the trust and safety of every community deserves. Like some of you that have been around for a while, I've worked with you on these issues for a long time. I know what works. Investigating crime prevention and community policing, cops who walk the beat, who know the neighborhood, and who can restore trust and safety. Let's not abandon our streets or choose between safety and equal justice. Let's come together and protect our communities, restore trust, and hold law enforcement accountable. That's why the Justice Department has required body cameras, banned choke calls, and restricted no-knock warrants for its officers. That's why the American Rescue Plan that you all provided $350 billion that cities, states, and counties can use to hire more police, invest in more proven strategies. Proven strategies like proven strategies like community violence interruption, trusted messengers, breaking the cycle of violence and trauma, and giving young people some hope. We should all agree the answer is not to defund the police.
That's right.
It's to fund the police. Fund them. Fund them. Fund them with resources and training. Resources and training they need to protect our communities. I ask Democrats and Republicans alike to pass my budget and keep our neighborhoods safe. And we'll do everything in my power to crack down on gun trafficking, of ghost guns that you can buy online, assemble at home. No serial numbers. Can't be traced. I ask Congress to pass proven measures to reduce gun violence. Pass universal background checks. Why should anyone on the terrorist list be able to purchase a weapon? Why? Why? And folks, ban assault weapons with high-capacity magazines that hold up to 100 rounds. You think the deer are wearing Kevlar vests? Yes. Look, repeal the liability shield that makes gun manufacturers the only industry in America that can't be sued. The only one. Imagine had we done that with the tobacco manufacturers. These laws don't infringe on the Second Amendment. They save lives. The most fundamental right in America is the right to vote and have it counted. And look, it's under assault. In state after state, new laws have been passed. Not only to suppress the vote, we've been there before, but to subvert the entire election. We can't let this happen. Tonight, I call on the Senate to pass the Freedom to Vote Act, pass the John Lewis Act, Voting Rights Act. And while you're at it, pass the Disclose Act so Americans know who's funding our election. Look, tonight, I'd like to honor someone who dedicated his life to serve this country. Justice Breyer, an Army veteran, constitutional scholar, retiring Justice of the United States Supreme Court. Justice Breyer, thank you for your service. Thank you, thank you, thank you. I mean it. Get up. Stand, let them see you. Thank you. And we all know, no matter what your ideology, we all know one of the most serious constitutional responsibilities a president has is nominating someone to serve on the United States Supreme Court. As I did 4 days ago, I've nominated the Circuit Court of Appeals Ketanji Brown Jackson, one of our nation's top legal minds, who continue in Justice Breyer's legacy of excellence. A former top litigator in private practice, a former federal public defender, from a family of public school educators and police officers, she's a consensus builder. Since she's been nominated, she's received a broad range of support, including the Fraternal Order of Police and former judges supported by Democrats and Republicans. Folks, if we're to advance liberty and justice, we need to secure our border and fix the immigration system. And as you might guess, I think we can do both. At our border, we've installed new technology like cutting-edge scanners to better detect drug smuggling. We've set up joint patrols in Mexico and Guatemala to catch more human traffickers. We're putting in place dedicated immigration judges in a significant larger number so families fleeing persecution and violence can have their cases heard faster and those who don't legitimately hear can be sent back. We're screening, we're securing commitments and supporting partners in South and Central America to host more refugees and secure their own borders. We can do all this while keeping lit the torch of liberty that has led the generation of immigrants to this land, my forebears and many of yours. Provide a pathway to citizenship for dreamers, those with temporary status, farm workers, essential workers. Revise our laws so businesses have workers they need and families don't wait decades to reunite. It's not only the right thing to do, it's economically smart thing to do. That's why the immigration reform is supported by everyone from labor unions to religious leaders to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Let's get it done once and for all. Folks, advancing liberty and justice also requires protecting the rights of women. The constitutional right affirmed by Roe v. Wade, standing precedent for half a century, is under attack as never before. If you want to go forward, not backwards, we must protect access to health care, preserve a woman's right to choose, and continue to advance maternal health care for all Americans. And folks, for our LGBTQ plus Americans, let's finally get the Bipartisan Equality Act to my desk. The onslaught of state laws targeting transgender Americans and their families, it's simply wrong. And I said last year, especially to our younger transgender Americans, I'll always have your back as your president so you can be yourself and reach your God-given potential. Folks, as I've just demonstrated, while it often appears we do not agree, and that we do agree on a lot more things than we acknowledge. I signed 80 bipartisan bills in the law last year, from preventing government shutdowns, to protecting aging Americans from still too common hate crimes, to reforming military justice, and will soon be strengthening the Violence Against Women Act that I first wrote three decades ago. It's important. It's important for us to show the nation we can come together and do big things. So tonight I'm offering a unity agenda for the nation. Four big things we can do together, in my view. First, beat the opioid epidemic. There's so much we can do. Increase funding for prevention, treatment, harm reduction and recovery. Get rid of outdated rules and stop doctors prescribing treatments. Stop the flow of illicit drugs by working with state and local law enforcement to go after the traffickers. And if you're suffering from addiction, you should know you're not alone. I believe in recovery, and I celebrate the 23 million Americans in recovery. Second, let's take on mental health, especially among our children whose lives and education have been turned upside down. The American Rescue Plan gave schools money to hire teachers and help students make up for lost learning. I urge every parent to make sure your school does just that. They have the money. We can all play a part. Sign up to be a tutor or a mentor. Children were also struggling before the pandemic, bullying, violence, trauma, and the harms of social media. As Frances Haugen, who is here tonight with us, has shown, we must hold social media platforms accountable for the national experiment they're conducting on our children for profit. Folks, thank you. Thank you for the courage you showed. It's time to strengthen privacy protections, ban targeted advertising to children, demand tech companies stop collecting personal data on our children, and let's get all Americans the mental health services they need. More people can turn for help and full parity between physical and mental health care if we treat it that way in our insurance. Look, the third piece of that agenda is support our veterans. Veterans are the backbone and the spine of this country. They're the best of us. I've always believed that we have a sacred obligation to equip those we send to war and care for those and their family when they come home. My administration is providing assistance in job training, housing, and now helping lower-income veterans get VA care debt-free. And our troops in Iraq have faced, in Afghanistan, have faced many dangers, one being stationed at bases breathing in toxic smoke from burn pits. Many of you have been there. I've been in and out of Iraq and Afghanistan over 40 times. These burn pits that incinerate waste, the waste of war, medical and hazards material, jet fuel, and so much more. And they come home, many of the world's fittest and best-trained warriors in the world, never the same. Headaches, numbness, dizziness, a cancer that would put them in a flag-draped coffin. I know. 13. One of those soldiers was my son, Major Beau Biden. I don't know for sure if the burn pit that he lived near, that his hooch was near, in Iraq and earlier than that in Kosovo, is the cause of his brain cancer, the disease of so many other troops. But I am committed to find out everything we can, committed to military families like Danielle Robinson from Ohio, the widow of Sergeant First Class Heath Robinson. He was born a soldier, Army National Guard, combat medic in Kosovo and Iraq, stationed near Baghdad just yards from burn pits the size of football fields. Danielle is here with us tonight. They love going to Ohio State football games. And they love building Legos with their daughter. But cancer from prolonged exposure to burn pits ravaged Heath's lungs and body. Danielle says Heath was a fighter to the very end. He didn't know how to stop fighting, and neither did she. Through her pain, she found purpose to demand that we do better. Tonight, Danielle, we are going to do better. The VA is pioneering new ways of linking toxic exposure to disease, already helping more veterans get benefits. And tonight, I'm announcing we're expanding eligibility to veterans suffering from 9 respiratory cancers. I'm also calling on Congress to pass a law to make sure veterans devastated by toxic exposure in Iraq and Afghanistan finally get the benefits and the comprehensive health care they deserve. And fourth and last, let's end cancer as we know it. This is personal. This is personal to me and to Jill and to Kamala and so many of you. So many of you have lost someone you love. Husband, wife, son, daughter, mom, dad. Cancer is the number 2 cause of death in America, second only to heart disease. Last month, I announced the plan to supercharge the cancer moonshot that President Obama asked me to lead 6 years ago. Our goal is to cut cancer death rates by at least 50% over the next 25 years. I think we can do better than that. Turn cancers from death sentences into treatable diseases. More support for patients and their families. To get there, I call on Congress to fund what I call ARPA-H, Advanced Research Projects Agency for Health, patterned after DARPA and the Defense Department, projects that led in DARPA to the internet, GPS, and so much more to make our forces more safer and be able to wage war more with more clarity. ARPA will have a singular purpose to drive breakthroughs in cancer, Alzheimer's and diabetes, and more. A unity agenda for the nation. We can do these things. It's within our power. and I don't see a partisan edge to any one of those four things. My fellow Americans, tonight we've gathered in this sacred space, a citadel of democracy, in this Capitol. Generation after generation of Americans have debated great questions amid great strife and have done great things. We fought for freedom, expanded liberty, debated totalitarianism and terror. We built the strongest, freest, and most prosperous nation the world has ever known. Now is the hour, our moment of responsibility, our test of resolve and conscience, of history itself. It is in this moment that our character of this generation is formed. Our purpose is found. Our future is forged. Well, I know this nation. We'll meet the test, protect freedom and liberty, expand fairness and opportunity, and we will save democracy. As hard as those times have been, I'm more optimistic about America today than I've been my whole life, because I see the future that's within our grasp, because I know there's simply nothing beyond our capacity. We're the only nation on earth that has always turned every crisis we faced into an opportunity. The only nation that can be defined by a single word, possibilities. So on this night, on our 245th year as a nation, I've come to report on the state of the nation, the state of the union. And my report is this: the state of the union is strong because you, the American people, are strong. We are stronger today. We are stronger today than we were a year ago. And we'll be stronger a year from now than we are today. This is our moment to meet and overcome the challenges of our time. And we will, as one people, one America, the United States of America. God bless you all, and may God protect our troops. Thank you. Go get him.
Well, you've been listening there to U.S. President Joe Biden delivering his first annual State of the Union address before a joint session of Congress. And as expected, Biden began his address on the Russian invasion of Ukraine, reminding Americans of the countless hours the U.S. and its allies have spent trying to get President Vladimir Putin to resolve the standoff peacefully to no avail. He spoke of the powerful economic, technical, military steps the U.S. has taken to cut and alienate the Russian leadership. He reiterated the U.S. will not fight Ukraine in Ukraine. Instead, it will spare no efforts to work with its European allies to pressure Russia through sanctions and other nonviolent means. Now, on the economy, Biden pointed to job creation and the 5.7% economic growth last year. It's a record in 40 years. Speaking clearly to his domestic audience, he talked about the infrastructure decade, rebuilding roads, bridges, clean water, building more electric vehicle charging stations. We also heard of a new catchphrase, building a better America. In it, among other things, he plans to cut the cost of prescription drugs and childcare. President Biden saying the current tax system was unfair. As such, he was capping taxes for low-income earners while increasing the tax for the wealthy. Now, COVID and Biden's next steps to move the U.S. forward include getting vaccinated. Free testing will be provided to Americans, preparing for new variants and opening up schools and businesses, and continue sending vaccines to the world. Now, those just a few of the top lines coming out as Biden slowly makes his way out. Let's go now to Simon Marks. He has been listening in Washington, D.C. to President Biden speak. Simon, rising inflation, Ukraine, a polarized America, and not to mention those approval ratings down. What sort of report card did President Biden turn in?
Good to see you, man.
Well, Jill, I mean, I think this was absolutely a speech that was 80% domestically focused. And that is a reflection of the political difficulties that the president knows that he's facing here. Just a matter of months before midterm elections, record low approval ratings that are besetting him. And one of the two women who was sitting behind him, Vice President Kamala Harris, whose approval ratings are even lower than President Biden's. As he leaves the chamber, we see him accepting congratulations for the speech from members of Congress. At one point, he was lingering with some of the left-wing members of the Congressional Democratic Caucus who have made his life so difficult getting so much of his legislation passed up on Capitol Hill over the last few months. But this speech, of course, began with the topic that it had to address right at the start. And that was Ukraine, and the President of the United States insisting that democracies are meeting the moment of the crisis sparked by Russian President Vladimir Putin's decision to launch an invasion of his Ukrainian neighbor. But this speech was notable in many ways for what the president didn't say. Once again, he made absolutely no demands in this speech of Vladimir Putin. There was no warning to the Russian president of the consequences that will follow unless there is a cessation of hostilities. No call voiced by the president in this speech for Russian forces immediately to withdraw from Ukraine. And at one point in the speech, he almost seemed to indicate that he knows that this is going to become a months-long battle for control of Ukraine. He said, "We remain clear-eyed. The Ukrainians are fighting back with pure courage, but the next few days, weeks, months will be hard on them." He said, "Putin has unleashed violence and chaos, but while he may make gains on the battlefield, he will pay a continuing high price over the long run." That was a pretty clear indication that the White House is still not entirely optimistic about the outcome of the conflict that is taking place and that has caused so much destruction to the northeastern city of Kharkiv, with that Russian convoy poised to attack Kiev in the days ahead. From there, the president went off on a lengthy list of domestic priorities and domestic issues without ever really returning to foreign policy. He mentioned China only twice in the speech, very briefly in passing. There was no mention at all of North Korea, no mention of Iran and the nuclear talks taking place there, barely a mention of the Asia-Pacific region, and certainly nothing about his intention to deepen his ties with both ASEAN and APAC. And there was another big miss in this speech that fell short of what the White House had told us to anticipate. The president only used the word climate twice in the speech, the word environmental once, and he never referred to global warming. And we were told that there were going to be some new initiatives in this speech relating to climate change, which is an issue about which he is absolutely passionate, Jill. And yet there was no expansive mention of climate change in this speech. So a fascinating, swift speech. We were all done in 62 minutes. It's going to be one of the shorter State of the Union addresses that I can remember covering here on CNA for many years to for many of the last years. The president now making his way still out of the Capitol as the cadences of that speech, Jill, continue to echo through the building.
And as you mentioned, what was missing from that speech, we will take up those topics with our guests a little later in the show. But I wanted to ask you, Simon, on the optics that surround the State of the Union. It's being watched for, you know, the showmanship of Trump in the past. And we all remember Pelosi ripping up his speech. Anything of note this year? Was he suitably presidential in his tone and address?
Yeah, well, I think there's no surprise that Nancy Pelosi didn't rip this one up. It was interesting, by the way, earlier in the day, Donald Trump was fundraising off the back of Nancy Pelosi ripping up his speech a couple of years ago and putting out the video clips of that in a fundraising email that he sent out to his supporters. Look, I think President Biden can be credited for having given the speech well. There's no question about that. And he won a rousing reception, as you would expect from Democrats. There was plenty in there for Republicans to pick over. I think that they are going to go in a major way for what they will see as the jugular. And that was the part of the speech where the president was talking about immigration, about putting the dreamers, those children of illegal immigrants, undocumented aliens in the United States, onto a path to citizenship. So I think that the Republican critique of this will focus on illegal immigration and also on the president's proposals, by the way, none of which were new in this speech, to introduce some measure of gun control, very limited. But essentially, one of the questions that I think the speech raised, much as it was being welcomed by members of his own Democratic Party on Capitol Hill, is why he had to ask Congress to get so many of the things done that President Biden, when he was campaigning, thought would be relatively easy to get done very rapidly. And of course, he's run into so much difficulty, partly because he doesn't essentially really have a working majority on Capitol Hill. I mean, he's got very thin majorities in the House of Representatives and no majority at all in the Senate, which is split 50-50. So he's run into all sorts of roadblocks, getting things that he thought would be very easy to pass through Capitol Hill. And that's why this speech essentially, in some ways, was the political equivalent of a list song. I mean, he ran through all the things that he wants Congress to act on. But realistically, he knows that there was nothing in this speech to change the very complicated political calculus that he faces on Capitol Hill. And many of those things simply are not going to get done.
Simon Marks, thank you for that initial analysis of the speech. Stay with us as we invite back once more our panel of experts. They are Professor Renee Van Vechten from the University of Redlands and Dr. Lim Tai Wei from the East Asian Institute at NUS. Professor Vechten, perhaps first to you, what were your key takeaways? And did Biden tick all these big ticket items that we were told to expect, or was it for you as well? What was not addressed that spoke louder?
Sorry, I was just interrupted. Can you repeat that last bit?
Did Biden tick all the big ticket items that we expected, or for you, was it about what was left out?
What really struck me about this speech was that it was very domestically oriented. It was replete with overtures to the other side, shall we say, that is, those who may not be his regular supporters. He spoke a lot in the end about some of the things that he'd like to accomplish. And so by that token, I think there was a glossing over of some of the big ticket items. You mentioned climate change. That's not one of the issues that brings people together. So he rather ignored it. He did mention it only a couple of times when it came to talking about electric cars and so forth. But there were more mentions of those items and those issues that you're going to get a lot of agreement from both sides on about that need to be fixed, such as immigration and childcare and cutting the cost of prescription drugs, for example. Those are the big applause lines. And I think that, and especially a support for veterans, right? These are the kinds of things that draw out the applause. And it sounded like he was looking for more applause than he was anything else. And he did get quite a lot of it. At the end, especially there, from people on both sides of the aisle, at least.
Dr. Lim Tai Wei, can I ask you for your thoughts about this? Because, of course, we anticipated that after the speech, we were going to be kicking over what the President of the United States had to say about China, what he had to say about East Asia, what he had to say about North Korea. And the reality is he had absolutely nothing to say about any of those places or locations. How do you feel that this speech will be interpreted, particularly tonight in Beijing?
Well, I think the context is very important. This is an extraordinary time. The speech is made during a pandemic. on its last legs, and a conflict that is ongoing in Europe that was rather unexpected in terms of its scale. Therefore, it made sense that he focused a lot on multilateralism at the start of his speech, particularly unity in foreign relations and how he coordinated with foreign allies in terms of energy reserves. In terms of domestic kind of politics, he focused on bipartisan issues. He really emphasized a lot on semiconductor investments, about the $20 billion that's invested in the U.S. And possibly expanded to $100 billion. He got applause from both aisles in the building when he talked about fund the police, cure for cancer, and also the infrastructure bill that was passed in order to improve bridges, etc., and other infrastructure, which he said is deteriorating. He also, highlighted the employment situation, where the jobless rate has dropped to 4%, and other issues in which he tries to reach across the aisles included support for the veterans, vaccination drive, live with COVID, continue to fight the virus with new vaccines, electric vehicles, community colleges, better wages, and more support for immigration officials. So I think what most allies as well as competitors in East Asia will be looking out for is how he can overcome polarization back home, how he can reach out to the moderates across the table, and how he could handle very controversial issues within the U.S. context, for example, gun control, Build Back Better. This will probably determine his assessment of his administration. But it seems like he's able to fulfill, at least in foreign diplomacy, the unity card that he has laid out when he was campaigning. It remains to be seen what will happen, given that there is much fluidity about the progress of the war in Europe. So we need to see how first he can reach across the aisle domestically and how he can cope with the fluid situation in Europe. And this will probably determine the evaluation of his assessment during the State of the Union address.
Thank you for that analysis. Now, President Biden did highlight the unified response to Russia's invasion aimed at punishing Moscow and supporting Kyiv. He says Putin shunned efforts to prevent war, rejecting efforts at diplomacy. Let's have a listen to what he said.
Putin's latest attack on Ukraine was premeditated and totally unprovoked. He rejected repeated efforts at diplomacy. He thought the West and NATO wouldn't respond. He thought he could divide us at home, in this chamber, in this nation. He thought he could divide us in Europe as well. But Putin was wrong. We are ready.
Professor Vecten, at least on the Ukraine issue, Biden does enjoy rare bipartisan support over taking on Russia and taking them to task for the invasion. Did he capitalize on that by reaching across the aisle?
Oh, absolutely. You saw that there was just universal support and a lot of standing ovations whenever the President Biden spoke in unmitigated terms of trying to show force and determination to meet the Russian aggression in a variety of ways. It's true that he didn't speak. He actually did say that we wouldn't be sending troops over into Ukraine, but that we would be shoring up our allies and preparing for any kind of other kinds of aggression. I thought it was interesting that as he spoke, he did continue to rally his supporters, and not just those in his own party, but Republicans really do want to see that we are going to have these sorts of shows of, shall I say, we want to show our strength. And that, whether it's symbolic or it's real, I think you have you'll see that there are signs of both of those things happening. And the kinds of things that Biden spoke about Some of them have a symbolic kind of value. Some of them have actual real value. So I think you'll see both of those play out in the next few weeks. I don't think that this is a kind of issue that will be resolved quickly, as we saw. But as we've also seen, Putin is not likely to give up. What kind of an aggressor likes to give up easily? But it did sound as if the kinds of steps that Biden's trying to take are those that are going to indirectly squeeze those who might be supporting Putin in this effort. So we heard him speak a lot about cutting off the toys, shall we say, the yachts and the airplanes of oligarchs, and cutting off their access to the kinds of places and spaces and ways in which they might be enjoying themselves. So it sounds as if the administration really is going to try to get at Putin through those who actually do support him. We'll see again if that really has the impact, the intended impact or not. But that clearly seems to be one of their big tactics, right? Part of the larger strategy of trying to take down Putin is to get at him through those who might be supporting him. And of course, the falling of the ruble today is a big sign, of course, that things are starting to crumble. The question is really, what kind of resolve will the Russian people have when it comes to his supporting their leader? 80% or so do still support him. So it will take quite a bit for his support to crumble, probably in his own country. But it sounds like Biden is really trying to extend that olive leaf in the ways that he can, but he also wanted to come across as being quite determined, which I think he did.
But Professor Van Vecken, can I just press you on that? Because with regard to the oligarchs and the trappings of their wealth, I mean, it's been reported over the last few days that Vladimir Putin personally moved his yacht back into Russian territory well ahead of the sanctions that President Biden is referring to in this speech tonight. And are you surprised, given that we're all so used to seeing American presidents, successive American presidents, George H.W. Bush telling Saddam Hussein his aggression in Kuwait would not stand, Barack Obama insisting publicly that Russia needed to withdraw its troops from the Crimean Peninsula in 2014. I mean, they didn't, but at least the demand was voiced. If you're Vladimir Putin sitting in the Kremlin listening to this speech, you've not heard a single demand of President Biden directed at you.
Right. And I think this is where we see Biden really trying to thread that needle between trying to tell Russia exactly what to do and also trying to make sure that we don't provoke Russia into a third world war. Right. I think that what you see Biden trying to do is not order what he considers to be a dictator around, although that probably would play well with a lot of audiences. I don't know what it would. We don't know with this unpredictable leader of Russia how he would take that sort of command, so to speak. Putin has an agenda, and he wasn't shy about reminding the world that they are a nuclear power. So I do think that Biden has to be a little bit careful in trying to take the stance that he can just tell Putin what to do. Because, of course, the last thing that we need to do is provoke an aggressive tyrant.
All right. Moving the discussion forward to the domestic front, Mr. Biden vowing to fight sky-high inflation in an 11th-hour effort to convince Americans that the economy is actually doing better than what the poll suggested. The U.S. economy last year grew at its fastest pace since 1984, but inflation hit 7.5% in January, the highest in four decades. Now, Mr. Biden says Americans have a choice in fighting these price hikes, calling for companies to lower costs by driving up production.
Lower your costs, not your wages. Folks, the That means make more cars and semiconductors in America, more infrastructure and innovation in America, more goods moving faster and cheaper in America, more jobs where you can earn a good living in America. Instead of relying on foreign supply chains, let's make it in America.
Dr. Lim, you heard there multiple times, make it in America. Biden pressing lawmakers to approve legislation to revitalize the high-tech American manufacturing and supply chains in the face of this growing threats geopolitical from China. The two chambers, though, remain at odds over how. Specifics, what exactly is Biden's strategy for boosting U.S. competitiveness with China?
Well, in the short term, the strategy is to stabilize the impact of the pandemic as well as the conflict in Europe. In terms of the pandemic, he has clearly said that the supply chain disruption is due to the after effects of the pandemic. And therefore, he empathizes with the difficulties that the American people faces from the fallout of the pandemic. So he's trying to ensure that using the infrastructure plan as well as to manufacture more goods within America, that, for example, semiconductor chips can be more self-reliant. He mentioned a number of factories will be set up within America itself, particularly by the Intel company, where he had the guest who is the CEO of Intel, attending the State of the Union address, standing up to standing ovation. So it appears that buying American products would mean less reliance on disruptions of supply chains from overseas, more reliance on American production, particularly on strategic items like semiconductor chips. He specifically used this in the context of cars, saying that the prices of cars have gone up in America. It hurts Americans who would like to buy cars during this period. And therefore, there's a need for semiconductors to be more self-reliant, which he has quoted as the main reason why car prices have gone up. Now, talking about the lower costs, lowering costs and not wages, this is, again, something that many countries, not just the U.S., is tackling because of the fallout from the pandemic. For example, there are debates going on in Europe about universal basic income. In Japan, there are talks about new economic policy. In China, they are talking about common prosperity fund. And so I think Joe Biden is trying to look at how it is possible to make lives of ordinary Americans better by having better wages. Now, he has also opened up another front, which is coordination with allies in terms of energy reserves. And this is another strategy that he has mentioned that will tackle the high energy prices that's expected from the conflict in Europe as well. So all these are kind of strategies that he has put in place for the short term to the medium term. And in the long term, infrastructure bill was what he touted about America building up its infrastructure, which he feels are deteriorating in order to compete better in the 21st century with other major powers. And he has carefully couched his talk about China, mainly in the context of economic competition, asking the president not to bet against the American people. So in this sense, he was very cautious and couched his economic plan very carefully in terms of market-driven competition.
Professor Van Vechten, do you think that in any sense Joe Biden has helped himself here tonight? And I mean that question in a couple of different ways. Is there any piece of legislation currently jammed up in the corridors of Capitol Hill that he might have succeeded in bringing over the finishing line with this speech tonight? And secondly, do you think he's helped himself with the public? Is he going to get a bounce in the opinion polls as a result of this speech?
Let me start with the latter part of your question. Will he experience a bump? It's very likely that he'll see in the coming week or so, maybe a point or two bump. But those bumps are short-lived. So we won't expect that it will have any real lasting effects. On the other hand, he was speaking to members of Congress tonight. And as he pointed out in his speech, he's actually signed almost 100 bills that are bipartisan into law. So it's not as if he hasn't done anything during the last year or that Congress itself doesn't work together. In fact, there are some synergies. And as we saw in the latter part of the speech, there are plenty of ideas and there are plenty of issues on which they can find common ground. The bigger question is, can they find common ground and can they actually unite in order to pass the bills that he wants them to pass? He mentioned a couple tonight. Of course, there's the Freedom to Vote Act, the John Lewis bill. It's named after a civil rights leader who passed away recently. There are holdouts on that bill, and it's unlikely that they're going to be convinced by any of what Joe Biden said tonight because they are adamantly opposed to some of the provisions in that bill. Now, on the other hand, it is possible to cleave off parts of that bill and perhaps create smaller bills. So we may, in fact, see that some of those ideas are put into different bills and maybe he gets a couple of those signed into law. But it doesn't look like the Voting Rights Act or voting bill is going to pass, the Freedom to Vote bill. It doesn't look like it will, in fact, get the momentum it needs just from this speech. So I think we like to talk about the importance of State of the Union addresses. They tend to excite the base of a party, of the president's own party, but they usually don't do much to mend fences. So in the coming weeks, again, he may recoup a couple of the points that he may have lost, but it's probably not likely to really last for very long.
Now, President Biden addressed the evolution of the pandemic and Washington's response going forward. He highlighted the tremendous progress the U.S. has made in its fight against COVID, putting the country in a position to move forward safely in the face of an unpredictable virus. Have a listen.
COVID-19 no longer need control our lives. I know some are talking about living with COVID-19, but tonight I say that we never will just accept living with COVID-19. We'll continue to combat the virus as we do other diseases. And because this virus mutates and spreads, we have to stay on guard.
Professor Van Vechten, Mr. Biden released Washington's new strategy, four prongs, I believe, on entering the next phase of the coronavirus pandemic. He is going to primarily rely on a widespread availability of vaccines and new treatments. But we all know it's a different reality across different parts of the country. And he is holding back a bit about declaring this new chapter in a pandemic. So to what extent is his message rather mixed?
It has to be mixed, and in part because there is a ceiling that we've hit with the number of people who want to be vaccinated. And barring a vaccine mandate, it's unlikely that we're ever going to reach the kind of herd immunity that we really hope to reach. I do believe that he can go further with vaccinating younger parts of the population. And he did mention that in his speech. He mentioned that eventually we will have a scientific response to vaccinating the youngest children among us. But even though vaccines have been widely available, there is a fairly large chunk of the American people that still doubts its efficacy and refuses steadfastly to become vaccinated simply because they feel that it's a matter of freedom or, for whatever reason, don't really want to get vaccinated. And then, of course, there is a sliver of the population that can't get vaccinated. So barring herd immunity, any kind of natural immunity, he knows very well that this will continue to be an issue for all of us. And he will continue to meet that challenge by some of the things that he talked about, which is preparing for new variants, as you say. On screen, I think you have some of the points that he mentioned. So he will, in fact, continue to ship vaccinations abroad. And that is going to be a real key in tamping down this pandemic across the world, because we don't want new variants, of course, to develop and spread. So being able to meet this the challenges of COVID-19 and all of its variants will take a multi-pronged approach, as he did outline. But will it eradicate it? Of course not.
Just on the issue of COVID-19, it is interesting to note that one of the few areas of the speech where President Biden ad-libbed tonight was where he added a reference to the fact that America will very soon mark its 1 millionth COVID-19 fatality. That mention was not included in the draft of the script of the speech that the president was expected to read. While we've been talking, the responses to the State of the Union address are underway. There are, I think, four of them this year from various wings of various parties. But the main Republican response has been delivered by the governor of Iowa, Kim Reynolds, and she has used her opportunity in the spotlight here very much to advance the argument that the Biden administration is on a variety of issues on the wrong track.
We're now 1 year into his presidency, and instead of moving America forward, it feels like President Biden and his party have sent us back in time to the late 70s and early 80s, when runaway inflation was hammering families, a violent crime wave was crashing our cities, and the Soviet Army was trying to redraw the world map. Even before taking the oath of office, the president told us that he wanted to, quote, make America respected around the world again and to unite us here at home. He's failed on both fronts.
Dr. Lim Tai Wei, I was wondering if I could ask you about the view of governments throughout East Asia and the Asia Pacific region of the debate that seems now to be really causing divisions within the Republican Party between moderate Republicans who absolutely hew to the traditional Republican orthodoxy, ready to go toe to toe, head to head with, in this case, the Russian leader Vladimir Putin. And those Republicans like Donald Trump and others who have expressed a degree of sympathy towards the Russian leader even as he invades Ukraine. How worried are audiences, governments throughout the region about where the Republican Party on that issue might be heading?
Well, the governments in East Asia can possibly be divided into four categories. The first category would be the U.S. allies in East Asia, for example, South Korea and Japan. These are treaty alliances that exist within East Asia. And for these countries, they prefer that the U.S. is able to reach out to the moderates on both parties and to reach compromises on various issues that has polarized American society, as well as its political elites thus far. They also hope that the war and conflict in Europe can be handled carefully because of ongoing conflicts within East Asia itself. Some of them have been equated with the conflict in Ukraine. Therefore, there is a desire amongst treaty allies that the peace can be restored in a way that does not disturb the international order and does not infect the East Asian sphere of international relations. There are also rivals and competitors within East Asia, and those governments would also want to see and have stakes in the international economy, being the global economy being insulated from the worst impact of the conflict in Europe. Given that economic recovery is still very much the priority in East Asia, particularly since many East Asian societies are perceiving the Omicron to be the start of a shift towards the endemic from the pandemic. Therefore, there is a lot of stake, even amongst rivals and competitors, for the United States to be able to put the house in order and be able to stabilize the situation in Europe. And for those in the category of much more non-aligned and neutral parties within East Asia, they would also hope that the conflict in Europe can be resolved peacefully, given that they are in a very difficult position to be able have to choose between diplomacy with Russia and diplomacy with the United States. Previously, they were already painted into a corner when they had to make a decision, as much as they do not want to, in the trade war and decoupling between US and China. Now there is an added dimension of Russia as well. Many of them are longtime friends and partners of Russia. So they do hope that this issue can be resolved quickly without opening yet another front within East Asian international and regional affairs. Therefore, these three categories of countries in East Asia, I think all points towards a commonality that they still hope that the conflict can be resolved peacefully. And the last category would be the strategic partners. Strategic partners within East Asia are neither treaty allies of the US, nor are they technically non-aligned. They do have security relations with the US, and they would want to see equilibrium in terms of a balance of power in the region, and also hoping out for peace in the European conflict with the global recovery very much in their mind. So a lot of attention will be placed on the conflict in Europe to see how it's eventually resolved, while East Asia is trying to vaccinate its way out of Omicron, perhaps the BA2 variant, and any other mutations that may come in the near future that appears to be expected by many experts.
Well, we leave it there for now. Our deep thanks to Professor Renee Van Vechten from the University of Redlands, Dr. Lim Tai Wei from the East Asian Institute at NUS, and Simon Marks in Washington. Thank you all so much for joining us through the analysis of the State of the Union address by President Joe Biden.